The endless parade of time. Who can say what fruits the future will see ripen? We can only keep looking towards
tomorrow's world with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95BFM.
This week, Stella and Isla are inspired by the recent controversy surrounding the proposed CBS show The Activist, in which contestants would be pitted against each other to achieve the greatest amount of change. They interview community psychologist Dr. Nikki Ha about why public outcry might have been so ferocious and her project that discusses the psychology of environmental activism, The Infinite Game.
Hi Earthlings, welcome back to the segment where we talk science and society.
Tomorrow's World. I'm Stella.
And I'm Isla.
And this is the segment focusing on how we the individuals are impacted by and can influence the world around us.
Last time we talked to Maria Corkin about her research on media exposure and development.
She also introduced us to the idea of technoference. You know, where even though you should be focusing on an online Zoom lecture, a notification really grabs your attention.
Maria suggested that turning off audible notifications is therefore not only beneficial to interactions with infants and children, but also for us big kids.
This week, we were inspired to talk about gamification in response to CBS announcing a new show, The Activist, where contestants will compete in being the most successful activist.
And despite already partially being filmed, the show has responded to enormous amounts of negative backlash and has taken a turn into a more documentary approach.
So they wanted to take activism, which at its core challenges capitalism and neoliberal systems, and turn it into a game show to make money.
But wait, there's more. Judges for the show included Jules Hugh and Priyanka Chopra Jonas, with the winning activist presenting at the G20 summit as the award.
Now, I can get behind game shows and reality TV, but this seems like the worst format imaginable for a show about activism. So we wanted to unpack the psychology of what might have been so wrong with this format and what made the backlash so great that CBS decided to change it altogether.
This week we have interviewed Dr. Nikki Hare from the University of Auckland, who's well established in community psychology and the study of psychology within sustainability.
Dr. Hare has published two books on the psychology of sustainability, one called The Infinite Game and the other called Psychology for a Better World.
They both tackle different angles on how our world is structured to promote behaviour that might not be so helpful and offer ways for us to engage in a different way of being.
The Infinite Game Project's basic idea is that two kinds of game exist, infinite and finite. The infinite game is one that's purpose is to keep our most important values in play, and the finite game's purpose is to win. Obviously, the activist is an example of a finite game, and finite games can further the infinite game or hinder it.
Yeah, so I'm in the School of Psychology at the University of Auckland, and I'm really interested in the way in which people work together for a better world. And the game side of it to me is really interesting, because often when people hear that I do games, they think I'm into competition, which I'm actually not. And it's also about the grand idea, if you like, that everything we do is uncertain. So to some extent, we're always playing games. We're always taking positions and we're acting as if we know what is the next move. But we have to, I think, hold a little bit of humility about the nature of the world.
That sounds like it holds some interesting tensions with what inspired us to cover the issue. Putting the idea of combining activism and entertainment into the context of your own work, particularly with your book, The Infinite Game, do you think that incentivizing activism in any way, does that serve a greater purpose, or does it aid progression of the infinite game, or is it more harmful than good?
My sort of initial reaction to that whole idea was pretty confused and a little bit terrified, to be honest. I guess for me, the key thing is staking people against each other, which is a thing that I really think is problematic, because in the infinite game, which you refer to, everyone is invited in is invited to share their strengths, and the key players, in a sense, the people that really make the game work, are the ones that know how to get the best out of others. So the whole thing is about an encouragement. And as soon as you set up a competition, how do you still keep the energy of a game-like structure without this thing of you win and you lose?
You touch on the desire to beat people in competitions there as being kind of a story that we tell ourselves when we think about how society operates. So do you think that competition is maybe a framework that we use for validation rather than a necessary part of human nature? And what could be an alternative to that narrative that we have to pit people against each other like this show was planning to do in order to receive recognition?
You know, reading about this activist show, I could see how the entire thing wasn't actually oriented towards producing the most good. It was oriented towards producing the most entertainment because the vehicle they'd chosen lends itself to that competitive structure. One of the reasons I think that we make a mistake when we think that people are naturally competitive is one of those levels problems. In other words, if you look at evolution as a whole, you can see that organisms compete in a sense to reproduce and survive. It's, you know, a tree takes sunlight from another tree and the tree that gets more light does better. But if we think of those trees, they're not really competing in a psychological sense. They're both just doing their own thing. And one happens to do better than the other. We make the mistake, I think, when we assume that because we look at people and can put a competitive frame on it, that therefore people are thinking competitively all the time. I mean, the example I use with my stage one psychology students around this is sexual intercourse between a man and a woman. We know biologically that that has to be related to the fact that it produces children. Like, surely there's something like that going on. But how many times do heterosexual couples have sex with the aim of having a child? Practically never. So in other words, if you like, the distal cause or reason for this behaviour doesn't mean psychologically that's what you're feeling when you're doing it.
Do you think that monetizing altruism and trying to incentivize it is paradoxical?
When we talk about incentives, it's important, I think, to have two distinctions. There's the intrinsic incentives and there's the extrinsic incentives. So money is an extrinsic incentive. In other words, it's removed from the nature of the task itself. So if somebody gives you money because you've done something, the doing of the something doesn't just naturally in and of itself generate the money. The money is an add-on, so it's extrinsic to the event itself. And I think we have to be extremely careful with those kinds of rewards because they're not actually encouraging the behaviour in and of itself. They're saying, if you do this, you'll get that. Whereas intrinsic rewards come about through the nature of the activity itself. And those are intrinsic to the activity. They come about just because of what you've done. Now, we as human beings need those kind of, if you like, incentives or rewards to keep going. And I think extrinsic incentives can sometimes be good, but they carry a big cost often that we have to be really careful about.
So obviously we're all really used to that kind of neoliberal structure that endorses the finite game, which is the opposite to the infinite game that you talk about. But that can be a really dark thing to consider. Actually, in your book, Psychology for a Better World, you discuss strategies that are maybe more likely to change people's behaviour than the doom and gloom approach. Could you outline those better strategies and maybe comment on what larger structures might be a better replacement for the system that we're currently working under?
A lot of those strategies, again, come down to this radical inclusion. Absolute thing it's all about is saying to everyone, you are welcome. You are valued. Thank you for showing up. I'm going to help you as much as I possibly can to be your best self in this space. So they all have that at the core of them. One really key one there is the idea of positivity, about saying there's hope. There's been quite a lot of research on social activists that shows that pretty much all people involved in social movements are angry. But the ones that are really active and effective also have these really high levels of hope. The sort of second key one I really want to draw attention to is the idea of the way people copy and model from each other. People are often really rude about individual change. As if here we have a huge planet on fire, why bother riding your bike and changing your light bulbs? But what they don't really understand when they say that is riding a bike actually is a really good example of something. It's actually quite a public activity. So when you ride your bike, lots of people see you ride your bike, and it adds to the whole momentum. It also means that you as an activist now know what it's like riding a bike in Auckland. And so if you're going to campaign for sustainable transport, you're doing it from a place of knowledge. And if we think of the modelling, what's people's primary learning mechanism? Copying. So when we do these things as an individual, people copy us. But even better, if we do them at an organisational level, then other organisations start to copy that. And now we're starting to wrap pretty big level change. Cities copy cities, countries copy countries. Look at the whole response to COVID. Everybody's looking to each other to try and figure out how to cope with this and how to manage this. Those mechanisms, inviting people in, being positive, being what the world could be, I think is another really key part.
What inspired you to put environmental activism into the framework of the infinite and the finite game? Because it is quite a unique framing.
I mean, the most honest answer is because I read James Carse's book, Finite and Infinite Games, and I thought, that's what I'm trying to do when I do sustainability. I'm trying to just keep the game in play. And I thought it could be applied in the context in which I was working. So that's when I set up workshops and eventually wrote a book with that metaphor at its heart. With an atheist background and no sort of conventional religion in my life, I felt we needed a metaphor in the secular world for how we could go about doing life. One of the great things is if you invite people into a game, you're not asking them to believe anything. And that was really important to me, that people could be invited into something without having to have a whole lot of ideological baggage about the meaning of life.
It's hard to mobilise people for a cause who don't all have identical beliefs. To explore how we could use religious frameworks in a secular way to further the common good, Dr. Haray has started a project called The Secular Priest.
Becoming immersed in Christianity, really trying to learn what people are understanding and getting from that in terms of their development and community and contribution. So if you get nothing else from this interview, go away and think, if you could be something for a year, what would it be?
Although you might not be on The Truman Show, it's nice to know you've got potential to start playing the infinite game.
Wowee, Stella, I am so inspired.
We hope you've welcomed yourself into the infinite game, Earthlings.
Stay critical and kia kaha in level 3.
Looks like everything's gonna be all right.
Tomorrow's World with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95 BFM.